Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Susan Shand, Phil Dierking, and Katie Weaver. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, the boys rescued from a flooded cave in Thailand earlier this month have cut all the hair off their heads. Their coach, who also was rescued, has done the same. The head shaving ceremony Tuesday was in preparation for their training to become Buddhist clergy. 11 boys and their coach prayed and offered drinks and food to spirits at a Buddhist temple. One team member who was rescued did not take part because he is not Buddhist. The chief of Chiang Rai's Buddhism office said the boys will do their Buddhist service in honor of Saman Gunan. He was the Thai former Navy SEAL who died on a dive in the cave's waterway to help the trapped team. Tradition calls for Buddhist males in Thailand to enter the clergy at some point in their lives. The service is to show thanks, often toward their parents, for raising them. It is also believed that they will gain goodness and protection through such service, and that those qualities will extend to their parents. The provincial governor said the boys and their coach will be ordained on Wednesday. After that, the group will stay for more than a week at a religious center near Thailand's northern border with Myanmar. The team and coach were released from a hospital last Wednesday. They had been trapped on June 23rd. British divers found them July 2nd, and a three-day effort to rescue them ended successfully July 10th. Around 200 people gathered to observe the head-shaving ceremony. Apinya Wintachai, a local Buddhist religious worker, said, "I was so happy to see them alive, and I thought it would be good to attend the ceremony to show them our support."
North Korea appears to have started dismantling important parts of its main satellite launch center. The activity appears to fulfill a promise to United States officials by North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un. Some experts believe North Korea is trying to build trust with the U.S. The two sides continue diplomatic talks aimed at ending North Korea's nuclear weapons program. Other experts say dismantling some parts of the launch area will not reduce North Korea's military ability. They also worry that the work is being done without verification. The website 38 North said satellite pictures from July 20th to 22nd show efforts to dismantle parts of the Sohae launch area. The parts include a rocket engine test stand used to develop liquid fuel engines. Such engines are used for long-distance missiles and space vehicles. A building where space launch vehicles were built before being prepared for launch also was taken apart, said 38 North. These facilities are believed to have played an important role in the development of technologies for the North's Intercontinental Ballistic Missile Program, Joseph Bermudez wrote. He reported the findings, saying that the North Korean efforts were an important confidence-building act. An official from South Korea's presidential office said Tuesday that Seoul has also seen the activities at the Seohee launch site. Other experts said North Korea is giving up little in dismantling the rocket engine test center. Adam Mount is an expert at the Federation of American Scientists. He said he is worried about North Korea's decision to dismantle its facilities without verification. Such a step would require international inspectors. In May, North Korean officials invited international reporters to watch the destruction of tunnels at its nuclear testing area, but they did not invite international experts. Mount said in an email that North Korea still has not dismantled centers that produce or store nuclear or missile systems or transportation for the missiles. Lee Chong-gun is a missile expert at South Korea's Science and Technology Policy Institute. He said the North's action was an important development and may lead to more activities at the area. Lee said if North Korea dismantles the entire Seohee launch area, it would greatly reduce the country's missile threat. He said other centers in North Korea are not as well built. But Mount disagrees. He said the threat reduction would be small. He added that North Korea has missiles that do not require a special launch center. After his meeting with Kim in Singapore on June 12th, Trump said he was told by Kim that the North was already destroying a major missile engine testing area. The two men ended the meeting by saying they both wanted a Korean peninsula free of nuclear weapons. But some experts do not believe Kim will ever give up his nuclear weapons because he may see them as the best guarantee of his survival as leader. I'm Susan Shand.
The College Board has answered criticism about proposed changes to the Advanced Placement World History Exam. Educators and others had objected to its plans to make the exam cover history beginning in the year 1450. So, now the group says the exam material will cover history beginning about 250 years earlier. The College Board announced the latest plan on its website last week. In the same announcement, the organization also proposed creating a new AP World History class called AP World History Ancient. That class would cover events from earlier than 1200 Common Era. The College Board said it values the thoughtful comments from the teaching community about the first proposal. The board said the reaction showed that it and educators share the same goals of engaging students in the rich histories of civilizations and making sure learning communities have enough time to cover such study.
The College Board is a not-for-profit group that directs the AP program and AP exams in American high schools. Schools pay for use of College Board AP teaching materials, including tests. The material on AP exams influences what information is covered in AP classes. The current AP World History class covers history from 10,000 years ago to the present. In May, the College Board announced that it wanted to limit the amount of material covered in its AP exam. It said it was acting partly because of messages from teachers who said they could not cover all the exam material in one AP course. The College Board also said that its AP History program should more closely copy college world history programs. They generally cover the subject in 2 to 3 separate courses. However, the College Board's first proposal of starting with the year 1450 received wide criticism from the U.S. teaching community. Many felt such a change would give Western European history higher importance in the class over other cultures.
Reactions to the newest plan have been mixed. Peter Stearns, a professor at George Mason University in Virginia, is pleased.
They're really trying to get a start date that avoids any impression that somehow world history has been guided by the rise of the West.
Stearns added that starting in 1200 permits the AP exam to include material on all sorts of societies that are not affected by Western influence at that point at all. However, other educators are not so happy. Mary Wiesner Hanks is a history professor at the University of Wisconsin and president of the World History Association. She sent a letter to Trevor Packer, head of College Board's AP program. Wiesner Hanks wrote that changing the course to begin at year 1200 will not address the foundational claims of world history as a field. She also said the speed in which these changes are being made is too fast. She said it does not provide enough time for thoughtful discussion on creating a new teaching program. And that issue has been one of the major issues expressed by teachers, Wiesner Hanks wrote in a separate email to VOA. Last month, the World History Association posted an open letter to the College Board online. The letter protested the changes. They called instead for an examination of the density of subjects covered.
Many educators are wondering if a whole new AP history class can be created. The College Board says on its website that to develop such a course, it would first need to confirm that colleges would be willing to give credit for an additional exam. And it said it would have to measure interest among high schools in offering 2 separate AP World History courses. GMU's Peter Stearns is not sure the idea is realistic.
Where I'm concerned more is I don't think lots of high schools have the resources or interest level to try to do 2 different AP World History courses.
He argues high schools are more interested in STEM subjects, science, technology, engineering, and math. Wiesner Hanks agrees, saying she fears only the wealthier schools will be able to offer two separate AP World History courses. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Phil Dierking.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. The Second World War ended with the surrender of Japan in August 1945. Americans looked to their new president, Harry Truman, to lead them into a new time of peace. Truman was vice president until President Franklin Roosevelt died suddenly in the closing months of the war. Almost no one expected President Truman to be as strong a leader as Roosevelt had been. And at first, they were right. Truman had one problem after another during his first months in the White House. Truman's first big problem was the economy. Almost 2 million Americans lost their jobs as factories ended wartime production. Americans everywhere worried about what would happen next. Only a few years before, the nation had suffered through the worst economic crisis in its history. No one wanted to return to the closed banks, hungry children, and other sad memories of the Great Depression. In some ways, the economy did better after the war than many experts had predicted. Many Americans still had money they had saved during the war, and Congress passed a law designed to help people keep their jobs. The situation could have been much worse than it was. However, the economy could also have been better, much better. Almost overnight, the price of almost everything began to rise. President Truman tried to stop the increases through a special price control agency that had been created during the war. However, thousands of business people refused to follow the government price control rules. Instead, they set their own prices for goods. Store owners would tell government officials that they were obeying the price controls, but often they charged whatever they wanted for the goods they sold. Businesses were not the only ones who were refusing to obey government price controls. Organized labor did the same thing. President Truman had always been a friend of labor unions, but during the first months of his administration, he became involved in a fierce struggle with coal miners and railroad workers. The first sign of trouble came in September 1945. A group of auto workers closed down factories at the Ford Motor Company. Then, workers at General Motors went on strike. Soon, there were strikes everywhere. The oil industry, the clothing industry, the electrical industry, and more. The strikes made Truman angry. He believed the striking workers were threatening the economy and security of the United States. He became even angrier when union representatives came to the White House and refused to accept a compromise wage offer. Truman ordered the army to take over the railroads and the coal mines. Within a short time, the striking coal miners returned to work. However, the president had less success with the railroad workers. He became so angry with the unions representing them that he asked Congress to give him the power to draft all striking railroad workers into the armed forces. The rail strike finally ended, but millions of Americans lost faith in Truman's ability to lead the country and to bring people together. By late 1946, most Americans believed that the man in the White House did not know what he was doing. Truman seemed weak and unable to control events. Union members disliked him because of his strong opposition to the coal and rail strikes. Farmers opposed Truman because of the administration's effort to keep meat prices low. Conservatives did not trust the reforms that Truman promised in his speeches, and liberal Democrats watched with concern as many of Franklin Roosevelt's old advisors left the government because they could not work with Truman. In November of 1946, the people voted in congressional and state elections. The results showed they were not satisfied with Truman and his Democratic Party. Republicans won control of both houses of Congress for the first time in 18 years, and Republicans were elected governor in 25 states. The election was a serious defeat for the Democrats, but a disaster for Truman. Some members of his party even called on him to resign. Few people gave Truman much chance of winning the next presidential election in 1948. However, Harry Truman began to change in the months that followed the 1946 congressional elections. He became a stronger speaker. He showed more understanding of the powers of the presidency. And in matters of foreign policy, he began to act more presidential. This was especially so in Truman's reaction to Soviet aggression in Germany. Truman wanted to rebuild Germany as well as the other war-torn countries of Western Europe. As we heard last week, his administration worked closely with Western European leaders to rescue their broken economies through the Marshall Plan. But the Soviets did not want to see Germany rebuild, at least not so quickly. At first, they flooded Germany with extra German currency in an effort to destroy its value. They walked out of economic conferences. And finally, in early 1948, they blocked all the roads to West Berlin. West Berlin was in communist East Germany, but not under communist control, as was East Berlin. After the war, the Allies had divided Germany in half. West Germany had a democratic government. East Germany was communist, under Soviet control. The Soviet actions in Berlin were a direct threat to the West. Truman had three difficult choices. If he did nothing, the world would think the United States was weak and unable to stop Soviet aggression. If he fought the blockade with force, he might start a third world war. But there was another choice. The Allies proposed the idea of flying tons of food, fuel, and other supplies into West Berlin. Not just once, but every day, as long as the Russians continued their blockade. It would be a difficult job. West Berlin was home to 2.5 million people. No one had ever tried to supply so large a city by air. Planes would have to take off every 3.5 minutes, day and night, to supply the people with enough food, medicine, clothing, and badly needed coal. The operation involved American C-47 and larger C-54 transport planes, along with British Lancaster, York, and Hastings aircraft. On June 26th, the first C-47s landed at Tempelhof Airport, the beginning of the great operation that was to come. Plans called for the operation to last just a few weeks. The planes landed in the blockaded city, and local volunteers provided support on the ground. Former mechanics of the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force, joined Americans in servicing the aircraft. More than 20,000 Berliners worked day and night to build an additional landing field for the American and British planes. It became Tegel, now Berlin's major airport. As part of the supply effort, the British Royal Air Force even landed Sunderland flying boats on a Berlin lake. Brigadier General Joseph Smith was appointed task force commander of the American part of the airlift. General Smith called the mission Operation Vittles, using an American slang term for food. Operation Vittles also led to Operation Little Vittles, or the dropping of chocolates and other treats to children. The pilots who did this became known as candy bombers. Appreciative German children called them the Schokoladenflieger, the chocolate pilots.
They wanted to know which airplane I was in. I said, you tell my airplane on regular wings, and then you'd know that's me. Watch just that airplane. And they says, good, that's Wunderbar. I came back the next day, and I put little parachutes for the Kalgoorlie and the Schokoladen so they could see it. And so it would hit it hard in the head, slow it down. And so I wiggled the wings, and boy, they waved their hands, and I pushed it out of the airplane. And that's how it started.
It was the idea of Gail Halverson, a pilot in the United States Air Force. Lieutenant Halverson became known as Mr. Wiggly Wings. From his plane, he would drop chewing gum and chocolates attached to tiny parachutes made from handkerchiefs. Soon, many of the airlift pilots were dropping candy from their planes, including into Soviet-controlled areas that they flew over. Americans back home supplied the handkerchiefs, and the chocolate industry supplied the treats. Years later, in Berlin, Gail Halverson told German interviewer Rolf Gründer how he got the idea.
I dropped chocolate because of gratitude. I met 30 children at the fence at Tempelhof, and not one put out their hands and says, give me more than flour, give me more than coal, give me chocolate. And they had no chocolate, they had no gum, but they would not be a beggar. They're so grateful for flour. And I said, wow, they were thankful. And when people are thankful, good things happen.
It soon became clear to the Soviets that the Berlin airlift would succeed. In May of 1949, almost 1 year after they had started their blockade, they ended it. The crisis in Berlin changed the way many Americans saw their president. Harry Truman no longer seemed so weak or unsure of himself. Instead, he was acting as a leader who could take an active part in world affairs. Truman's popularity increased. However, most Americans did not expect him to win the election in 1948. Almost everyone believed that the Republican candidate, New York Governor Thomas Dewey, would capture the office. The election campaign that year turned out to be one of the most exciting and surprising in the history of the nation.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.